the day's politics, current affairs and culture. ABC Radio National Drive. Stick around for PM. Have a nice weekend.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, international leaders plead for calm as Israel launches airstrikes on Lebanon and Hezbollah vows to retaliate. Also, the Vice-Chancellor of Sydney Uni apologises to Jewish students for the handling of cases of anti-Semitism. And passionate footy fans head to Sydney for tonight's AFL prelim final between the Swans and Port Adelaide.
I just want to win. I don't care how. It could be 1 point. I don't care.
Yeah, I get very, very nervous. So if it gets close, I sort of go up in the stand and start pacing around.
First quarter is going to be very telling. I hope it's going to be a great game.
As the tension between Hezbollah and Israel continues, the United Nations peacekeeping force in South Lebanon is urging both sides to pull back from their attacks. UNIFIL, as the peacekeepers are known, says it's seen a big increase in hostilities at the Lebanese-Israeli border, where Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah have been firing at each other for nearly a year. On Thursday, Israeli warplanes carried out the conflict's most intense strikes on southern Lebanon. That assault came after attacks earlier this week, which blew up thousands of Hezbollah pagers and walkie-talkies, killing at least 37 people and wounding thousands. David Escort prepared this report.
In Beirut's southern suburbs, a funeral procession is held for two Hezbollah militants killed in explosions. Crowds gather around the coffins of Fidel Abbas Bazzi and Ahmad Ali Hassan. A Hezbollah supporter and mourner, Miriam Darwish, remains defiant in the face of Israeli bombing.
This did not affect us, nor did it make us afraid. On the contrary, it increased our morale, strength, determination, and will stand against the Zionist enemy and tell them that we are strong. We will continue in marches and celebrations, and we will keep chanting.
About 80 kilometres south, in the Lebanese town of Tyre, close to the border with Israel, debris from exploded electronic devices litter their town. Locals are cleaning up as the world watches on, nervous the heightened conflict will erupt even further. Marwan Mahfouz is a Tyre resident. He says the spectre of war has lingered over his town for a while now.
He should just come in. He's been talking for a year about all-out war. What's the delay? What is the delay? He's been threatening us throughout the last year about this all-out war. OK, just do it. If we're going to die, we'll die. We are already dying.
Israel this week carried out dozens of airstrikes in Lebanon. The strikes happened after Hezbollah's leader promised retribution for Israeli attacks, in which pagers and walkie-talkies used by Hezbollah members exploded. According to Lebanon's health ministry, 37 people were killed by the exploding devices on Tuesday and Wednesday. The explosions have left nearly 3,000 injured, having a huge impact on Lebanon's already fragile health system, according to the World Health Organization. Hassan Nasrallah has promised retaliation.
The only path forward is to stop the aggression and war on the people of Gaza and the Gaza Strip, and consequently on the West Bank. That is the only path. Apart from that, there is nothing. No military escalation, no killing, no assassinations, and no all-out war can return the population to the borders. Never, God willing. On the contrary, what you are doing will increase the displacement of the population in the north.
The Israeli bombardment marks an expansion of reciprocal tit-for-tat attacks that have been taking place near the border for the past 11 months. The strikes did, however, avoid population centres. In anticipation of Hezbollah's retaliation, European powers have called for a ceasefire. David Lammy, Britain's Foreign Secretary, had this to say after meeting with allies.
We, of course, discussed the situation in Lebanon, which is of huge concern. And all of us are monitoring it very closely. We are all very, very clear that we want to see a negotiated political settlement so that Israelis, can return to their homes in northern Israel, and indeed Lebanese can return to their homes. And that's why tonight I'm calling for an immediate ceasefire from both sides.
Back in Tyre, another resident, Ali Abu Hashem, reflects on the past week. He says he is not scared.
Whatever happens is from God and is good. They are the enemy. You can expect anything from them. But God is with us. We only fear God. Whatever they do, we are not scared. We will remain loyal and determined. We will protect our land, and the resistance will continue to fight for victory.
That's the voice of South Lebanese man Ali Abu Hashem, David Escort reporting. Well, here in Australia, the federal government is warning Australians not to travel to Lebanon due to the volatile security situation. As Rachel Hayter reports, Lebanese Australians are worried about their loved ones in the region.
Haifa Bakur is a young Muslim Lebanese-Australian woman. She's 27 years old and studying developmental psychology at the University of Sydney. And she's really worried about her family in Lebanon.
It's pretty scary. It's really concerning. One of my younger sisters recently moved and is living there with my brand new baby niece and her husband and their family. And I know that they're pretty far away from the south of Lebanon, but it's very anxiety-inducing.
Their extended family in Lebanon try to reassure them that because they're a long way from the violence in the south, they're safe. But it's a massive adjustment after growing up in the peace of Australia.
We were raised here, so it's still really difficult, especially because when they do the attacks, they fly right on top of where she lives. And so it's traumatising for her and the baby in that sense to hear that and to see that.
Australian government advice is for Australians in Lebanon to leave immediately while commercial flights are still available. They warn that the security situation could deteriorate rapidly with little or no notice and that attacks could happen anytime and anywhere, including in Beirut. Haifa Bakur finds those warnings difficult to process.
It's somewhat frustrating because it feels like if something was to go wrong, you've done it to yourself. It just feels like it's just disregarding that, you know, people don't just go there for holiday. You know, they're not just going there to have some fun and, you know, to hang out on the beach and to go out. They're going there to visit blood relatives.
She says her grandparents who live in Lebanon are very elderly.
When we go to visit them, every time we go, it could be the last time. We have to balance that with the risks of, you know, having the airport potentially close on us and not being able to get back the only possible caretakers that could physically look after them live here. So my dad and his brothers being kind of like the most capable of taking care of their elderly father, they're not in a position where, oh, okay, they can choose to just not go.
President of the Australian Lebanese Association, Raymond Najjar, is also worried about his family in Lebanon.
They're surviving and they're used to surviving under these kinds of pressures. And Lebanon's not new to violence. Our relatives are finding life, cost of life, quite expensive because of the devaluation of the currency. But they have a philosophical view that they will continue to, you know, live through that and come out the other side. And whether we call it optimism or not, but that is all they have.
And Raymond Najjar says it's hard watching on from afar, feeling helpless.
It does worry me because basically I'm here 10,000 kilometres away and I'm unable to assist their plight in any way at all. We're very dismayed about the current situation, that Lebanon's being dragged into a war that it can ill afford and it really has no place to be in.
Lebanese Association, Raymond Najjar, Rachel Hayter with that report. The head of the University of Sydney has apologised to Jewish students and staff, admitting he failed them in his handling of a pro-Palestinian student encampment. The Vice-Chancellor, Professor Mark Scott, has been fronting a Senate inquiry into anti-Semitism on university campuses. It was convened after protester tent cities were set up at several unis earlier this year. Isabel Rowe is a federal political reporter for the ABC. Isabel, what's this hearing been told today?
Well, this is a hearing into a proposition by the Coalition to set up a commission of inquiry into anti-Semitism on campus. And this bill was put forward following what were several encampments, you might remember, earlier this year that sprung up on university campuses in Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, Adelaide and Canberra. That was a movement of students for Palestine that started in New York at Columbia University. And these students were calling for their teaching institutions to disclose and cut ties with weapons manufacturers that they said were supplying arms to Israel. Now, as part of this inquiry today, they've heard from some Jewish students who have condemned the University of Sydney in particular. One student, Zachary Morris, who is the National Vice President of the Australasian Union of Jewish Students, said that the University of Sydney is probably one of the worst places to be a Jewish student right now. And he made those claims based on the behaviour that he said was happening during those encampments. Also giving evidence in this inquiry is the University of Sydney's Vice-Chancellor, Professor Mark Scott. He told the inquiry that New South Wales Police offered to move that encampment on earlier, but that they declined that offer because New South Wales Police said that they would use the riot squad. And Mark Scott said that he felt that the risk of violence would ensue from that and the destruction of property would be an escalation, and they were trying to de-escalate that situation. Mark Scott has had a bit of a terse interaction with Liberal senators, particularly Liberal Senator Sarah Henderson, as part of this inquiry, where he's made an apology for how Jewish students have felt.
Professor Scott, do you believe that you have failed Jewish students and staff at the University of Sydney?
Senator, I have read those testimonies, as I've said. Those testimonies are searing. And if students have felt unsafe or unwelcome, if that has been their lived experience, if that is their testimony, then we have failed them.
It is their testimony.
Yes.
Professor.
Well, no, that's exactly right, Senator. And
so
that's
you have
why.
Failed them.
That, yes.
It's no ifs or buts. It is
no,
their testimony.
I accept that, Senator. That's their testimony.
And you have failed them,
Senator.
Yes. I failed them, and the university has failed them, and that is why we have made significant changes to our policy settings.
That's Professor Mark Scott, the Vice-Chancellor of Sydney Uni. And Isabel, the head of the Australian National University, has also been questioned about a candidate running for the student union. That person's publicly expressed support for Hamas. What has the university told the inquiry about that case?
Yes, so the ANU's Vice-Chancellor, Professor Genevieve Bell, also gave evidence today and was asked specifically about this issue. This is a student called Beatrice Tucker who was expelled over comments that she made initially on ABC Radio earlier this year, where she expressed unconditional support for the militant group Hamas. The Senate inquiry has been told that Ms. Tucker has now been permitted to continue as a student again following an appeals process and is in fact running for president of the ANU's Student Association. Professor Bell was questioned by Senators Henderson and Liberal Senator Paul Scar again. She told the hearing that she wouldn't comment on the individual cases. She said that student politics was a complicated place. One of the things about being a university is that she needs to create room for students, space to be able to engage in creating political categories and behaviours. They were her words that didn't go down particularly well with Liberal Senator Paul Scar, who said that this isn't a complicated issue, for goodness sake. And Senator Scar said he hoped that this student, Beatrice Tucker, didn't win that election.
Isabel Rowe reporting from Canberra. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, central banks around the world have been making interest rates decisions this week. What will our Reserve Bank decide next Tuesday? The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is in the United States this weekend for a meeting with the other leaders of the Quad Alliance countries, the US, Japan and India. In Philadelphia today, Mr. Albanese said he'd be having very direct discussions about China with Joe Biden, Fumio Kishida and Narendra Modi. For more on what the Quad leaders will discuss this weekend, I spoke to Susanna Patton, the director of the Southeast Asia program at the Lowy Institute.
I think the main discussion behind closed doors will very much be about regional challenges, meaning shared concerns around China, around maritime security in the region, and the way that China's rise is playing out in different parts of the region. So all of the Quad countries have their own concerns and challenges with China, and I think the discussion behind closed doors will really be laser focused on how the leaders can take an alternative vision to the rest of the region. Now, that's quite different to what will be presented externally because, of course, there's a very clear effort by these countries to not have this be seen as an anti-China initiative and to have it with a more positive outward-looking focus. But there's no doubt that that's the real agenda behind the scenes.
So what do you think this alternative vision for the region that you mentioned might be?
So the narrative of the Quad is very much about providing countries in the Indo-Pacific, whether that's in Southeast Asia, the Pacific or South Asia, with public goods. So the Quad has had initiatives on vaccines, on infrastructure, and I think we'll see more on healthcare, we'll see more on maritime security cooperation, encouraging countries in the region to be able to improve their own awareness of their own maritime domains. So these are important priorities that the Quad has identified, and all of that is aimed at shoring up what they call resilience, so the ability of other countries in the region to stand up to China and be secure and prosperous.
There are reports in the United States that Joe Biden is wanting to what's been called future-proof the Quad as he leaves office. Do you see any risks to the alliance?
So I think it's important to distinguish between the Australia-US alliance, which is heavily institutionalised, and the Quad, which is a very loose and flexible grouping. And the idea that you can future-proof the Quad, I think there's reasons to be sceptical about that because it is by definition something that is fairly light touch and is intended to be flexible. And in fact, it's a flexibility, the fact that it's being held in the United States rather than in India this year, where it would have been if it had have been strictly rotated among the members. So I think there are real risks under either a Trump or a Harris administration. Certainly in the case of Trump, we know that he doesn't take the same view that Biden does about the value of alliances and partnerships. And then even in the case of Harris, we would expect to see more continuity, but there are always doubts about whether or not the US will be able to continue prioritising Asia in the face of global priorities in the Middle East and Europe and elsewhere. On the plus side, though, I think what won't change is that all of the four countries in the Quad will continue to see a strategic rationale for their cooperation. So regardless of who would come to power in Japan or Australia, I think any leader in either of those countries would be supportive of the Quad because they would see the Quad as an important way to keep the US committed to the region and to manage shared concerns around China.
Unlike the leaders of the United States, Australia and Japan, India's leader, Mr. Modi, still has a cordial relationship with Russia's Vladimir Putin. Will that relationship and the war in Ukraine be raised by the other leaders with Mr. Modi in this Quad meeting?
I don't think so, because I think we've seen since the invasion of Ukraine a very deliberate decision by the United States and by other countries like Australia that they are not going to allow their relationships with India to be held hostage to India's position on Russia.
That's Susanna Patton, the director of the Southeast Asia program at the Lowy Institute. Human rights campaigners are calling for more action to tackle the scourge of modern slavery in regional and rural Australia. A report released this week in New South Wales found worrying examples in that state of migrant workers being subjected to forced labour, sexual servitude, and what's known as debt bondage. Experts say the problem exists across the country, and they're worried the new National Anti-Slavery Commissioner might not have strong enough powers to investigate. Kelly Fuller has more.
Slavery is a phenomenon we often think of as existing in another country or another time. But the evidence is growing that it's happening right here in modern Australia.
And we're thinking about that's a problem over there. And too often we're not looking in our backyard.
Justine Nolan is director of the Human Rights Institute at UNSW. She says a landmark report released by the New South Wales Anti-Slavery Commissioner this week sheds light on how a new type of slavery has taken hold in that state.
This report is raising an issue around labour hire, looking at the problem of intermediaries being involved, to sort of the continual drive to save costs, and that costs are coming off the backs of workers, in this case in particular, the plight of migrant workers.
The Commissioner, James Cockayne, found an estimated 16,400 people are trapped in modern slavery in the state, working in agriculture, horticulture and meat processing in rural and regional areas. Many are employed through the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Program, which can force people onto four-year contracts with the same employer. Moe Turaga is a former migrant worker and was on the Commissioner's investigation team. He says migrant workers have faced forced labour, debt bondage, people trafficking and deceptive recruitment practices. The workers get locked into a situation that's extremely difficult to get out of. There's also a lack of medical care and safe accommodation.
Too often, my brothers, my sisters, they find themselves without access to essential services and supports when they leave their employment schemes such as PALM. Often they live for their own safety, and because the deal they were promised is not the deal they are given once they arrive.
And experts warn the problem of modern slavery is spread throughout Australia. At the federal level, the government announced it would establish a National Anti-Slavery Commissioner earlier this year. No one's been appointed to fill that role yet. And even when it's filled, Professor Justine Nolan says it looks like they may not have been given enough power to do their job properly. Fiona David shares that concern. She's the CEO of Fair Futures and created the Global Slavery Index. She says the incoming National Commissioner deserves powers similar to the Australian Security and Investment Commission.
They have the powers to go in and look behind the scenes of what companies are doing. They have the powers to require documents. They have the powers to bring cases. So why is it that our company regulators have these sorts of really strong powers, yet in the modern slavery context, the commissioner is being asked to operate with much less powers than what something like ASIC would have, for example?
A spokesperson for the Federal Attorney General says the Albanese government is prioritising tackling modern slavery and recruitment of the federal commissioner is underway. A spokesperson for the New South Wales Attorney General says it is considering the request for a state parliamentary inquiry. The ABC contacted the New South Wales Farmers Association and the National Farmers Federation for comment.
Kelly Fuller reporting. Well, it's been a big few days for interest rate decisions, with the US Federal Reserve announcing a cut yesterday to support the American economy. The Bank of England followed, choosing to keep interest rates unchanged. And today, the Bank of Japan also left its monetary policy on hold. So, do those decisions give us any clues as to what our Reserve Bank might do next Tuesday? David Taylor is our business reporter. David, first let's look at these different decisions made by the central banks in the US, Britain and Japan. Why is the US Federal Reserve cutting rates while the others are on hold?
Well, Sam, the Federal Reserve's half a percentage point interest rate cut is being viewed as an economic preemptive strike. So while the US jobs market is holding up okay, the Federal Reserve doesn't want to take any chances that it will ultimately deteriorate. So a big interest rate cut is really designed to prevent the economy slowing down and lots of job losses. The Bank of England cut interest rates in August, but held steady overnight because the progress that has been made to reduce inflation has since stalled and it doesn't want to take any chances. The Bank of Japan's in a completely different position. Its interest rates have been at zero for a long time. It raised interest rates last month, but that became a catalyst for a major financial markets rout that lasted a couple of days. So the central bank has done the safe thing now by holding policy steady.
So where do you think that leaves our Reserve Bank with its rates decision on Tuesday?
Well, in some senses, it's completely independent, and in other senses, it does need to watch what other banks do. But that said, the Reserve Bank is widely expected to leave interest rates unchanged on Tuesday when the board finishes up a two-day meeting starting on the Monday. Paul Bloxham is the chief economist of HSBC Australia. He says while the Reserve Bank is aware of how much financial pressure millions of mortgage borrowers are under, it's still not confident that it's won the battle against elevated inflation.
Inflation is coming down more slowly here than elsewhere. And so then I guess the question is, why is that? Why is inflation proving to be stickier? Why is it still well above target? I think there are a few answers. I think one of them is, well, the RBA took a different approach. It lifted interest rates by less than everyone else. It lifted rates by 425 basis points. The Fed did 525, and so did, for example, the RBNZ. And they did that on purpose. They intended to stay as close to full employment as possible while still getting inflation to fall, but accepting along the way that inflation would fall more slowly. And so that's precisely where we are.
That's HSBC Australia Chief Economist Paul Bloxham. Now, Sam, it's important to note that while other central banks have started cutting rates ultimately in terms of the cycle, interest rate cutting cycle, it's because they began cutting at a higher starting point than the Reserve Bank.
Our business reporter, David Taylor. Well, footy fans from across the country are in Sydney for tonight's Do or Die AFL prelim final between the Swans and Port Adelaide. But some of their journeys weren't easy. Port fans flying to Sydney for the match had their morning flight cancelled just 1 hour before it was supposed to take off. Kathleen Ferguson prepared this report.
It was a tough morning for some of Port Adelaide's most committed fans.
It's going to be tight getting to the game, but yeah, look really annoyed and frustrated.
Their Qantas flight was cancelled because of an engineering issue. People were offered refunds or spots on other flights later in the day, but some cut their losses and bought new flights to get in a little earlier before kickoff at the SCG. Those at Adelaide Airport who did manage to avoid the cancellation were in high spirits.
Could sing the song at a pretty young age, so yeah, it's in the blood. It's in the blood.
Just want to win, I don't care how. It can be 1 point, I don't care.
And at Sydney Airport, it wasn't just South Australians wearing Port Adelaide's colours.
I've come from Launceston in Tasmania today.
Right, who's going to win?
Oh, look, I honestly don't know. I hope it's going to be a great game.
AFL Fans Association President Ross Isco says it would have been a tense morning for those who had their flight cancelled.
My heart goes out to any fan that would happen to, and any fan that's travelling to see their team play in a preliminary final with a chance to make it to the grand final. That is devastating.
But he says he has no doubt fans would have gone to great lengths to figure out another way to get to the SCG to cheer on their team.
Well, if let's just say they couldn't make it by air, they'd probably be driving, and even if they saw half a game, they'd still go and see half a game. That's how dedicated AFL fans are. So I congratulate them all for doing their best to getting there. And I wish the fans a good, nice, close game. They probably don't want that.
Senior lecturer in sport management at Deakin University, Hunter Fujak, says Australia's dedication and love for sport is quite unique.
Firstly, we have one of the highest concentrations of sport in the world. When you look at obviously having four discrete football codes and not necessarily having one dominant sport, you know, we support a lot of different sport teams and a lot of different codes in our country, which contrast to places like Europe, who are obviously soccer mad, for instance, or India being cricket mad. And then secondly, sport is very much embedded in our culture, so we invest a lot of government funding.
He says with most Australians ticking the census box indicating they are interested in sport, it makes sense that they care so much and that they're willing to make such an effort when travelling interstate.
We can think of these as being somewhat like a pilgrimage, in the same way we can think of religions having certain pilgrimages as well. And that reflects that, you know, in most leagues, in big leagues, you might have 16, 17, 18 teams in them. And so success does not come every year. And given how much we emotionally invest in our sport teams, when there is that opportunity to see them at the pointy end of the season, cost becomes very secondary to taking advantage of that opportunity.
He says supporting a team brings us together.
That's one of the big appeals of sport in our culture. And we saw it with the Matildas effect, where everyone came together as a nation to support that team. And that's underpinned, as sport is, by this idea of social identity theory that, you know, we identify with our tribe, whether that's, you know, Australia, whether that's New South Wales, Queensland, whether that's with our specific team in a league. You know, these form part of our social identities, and people who might otherwise be strangers to us become part of our clan.
And AFL fans aren't the only ones experiencing footy fever. The North Queensland Cowboys are going up against the Cronulla Sharks in the first NRL semi-final round tonight.
Kathleen Ferguson reporting. And that's PM for this week. Thanks very much for your company. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
ABC News with Glenn Lauder. The Israeli military says its warplanes have struck more than 100 Hezbollah rocket launches in southern Lebanon. The airstrikes come as Israel's Defence Minister Yoav Gallant says battle plans for the Israel-Lebanon border area have been approved. Speaking after a meeting with the US, France, Germany and Italy, the British Foreign Secretary David Lammy is urging both sides to agree to a ceasefire.
We are all very, very clear that we want to see a negotiated political settlement so that Israelis can return to their homes in northern Israel, and indeed Lebanese can return to their homes.
Meanwhile, the Australian National University's vice-chancellor has refused to comment on a student who expressed their unconditional support for Hamas at an inquiry into anti-Semitism at Australian universities. Beatrice Tucker was expelled over the comments made about the militant group earlier this year. The Senate heard they've now been permitted to continue as a student again and is now running for the president of the ANU Student Association. Professor Genevieve Bell has told the hearing she'd not comment on individual cases.
Student politics are a complicated space, but one of the things about being a university is that we create room for our students to engage in creating their own political categories and behaviours.
The effectiveness of Quad talks between Australia and three of its largest allies are being questioned as the country's leaders begin arriving in the United States. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has touched down in America to meet his counterparts from Japan, India and the United States for the high-level talks.